Okay, I guess we're up to the final stage. Yes?
Can CSX Lite have multiple declarations on one line?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. And it just follows the fact that where you appear on a line number is less important. Remember I said a while ago that you could actually have everything on a single line with no line breaks at all. It'd be a terribly ugly program, but you could do it. So yeah. And don't worry about it. What happens is the scanner will scan it and parse it, and it'll simply give the same line number to do two different declarations. And you're counting on the user being smart enough to say, well, okay, here's the line, and there's the declarations, and here's the one that I must be talking about.
So in our printout, should it be sorted by the column it appears in, or should that not?
It'll happen automatically. What'll happen is you'll encounter these guys in left to right, top down order. And as long as you enter these at the end of a list, if you have A and then B and then C on a single line, what'll happen is in your data structure, the entry for A will be created first, and then B and then C. So when you list them out, you'll see them in order left to right on the line in question. And that, I think, is just what you'd want to see.
But if you're using something like a hash table that's mapping it, the values in that might not be sorted by how they're
Right. But this is not the hash table. This is that data structure I talked about reverse engineering. You're going to have a data structure that's a list, not a hash table, a list of each identifier as you encounter it. And that'll be strictly left to right, top down order, just as if you were reading a book. And each one of those will have, here's a declaration on this line, its name, its type, and a list of all the places where it eventually was used. And as long as you traverse that structure in the order in which it was built, it's sorted for you. So its life is a lot easier than you might have feared. I was careful to build it that way to make it work, but it works out nicely. So we were talking about symbol tables, and the last thing I wanted to mention is how you build one. And in the old days in classes, we actually had people build hash tables as part of their programming exercise. Those are in the pre-Java days. One of the good things about Java, C++, C Sharp, which is kind of like Java, changed a little bit by Microsoft. I think some people said they use C Sharp here. And again, it's pretty close to Java, but not quite. In some ways better, and certainly in some ways different. It's the case that they have tremendously good libraries. So how could you do it? One way, if you really wanted to build it, there might be an efficiency problem, but it probably would not be noticeable except in an extreme case, is simply an ordered list. That is, if I wanted to have a table of identifiers, I'd sort them A, then B, and then C, and just do a search finding them, either binary search or a linear search. If you want to program it that way, fine, but it's not as good an implementation as others. When you took 367, you probably learned about binary search trees. Those are nice because you can have a lot of data that you get to quickly. One bad problem about a binary search tree is it's vulnerable to one particular entry order, which alas is common, and that's alphabetic order. Some people are taught programming, I don't know if you are, that if you have multiple declarations, put them in alphabetic order so a human reader can find them easily. That's probably pre-Eclipse days. So it says if you have lots of declarations, alphabetize them for human readership. If you do that, it turns out a binary search tree is bad because it degenerates to a linear list, which is what we want to avoid. So the most popular choice is a hash table because Java has an excellent implementation of hash tables. By that, I mean if you build a hash table conventionally, you have to ask, how big should I make it? If you make it too small, you're going to overflow it. If you make it real big, you're going to waste space. What happens is the Java hash table class allows you to suggest how big you want something to be, but as the table gets bigger and more filled, it will automatically double it for you without you intervening. So it'll say, oh, he guessed wrong, it's too small, let's make it bigger. And I think what it does is double. It starts to fill up again, let's make it bigger still. And therefore, it's very flexible, and it's all programmed for you. So I'd say you'd be foolish if you didn't use a hash table, or there's something called a hash map, which is fairly similar. You may use that too. So best recommendation is let the smart people who did Java do the work for you and use it. That's a single hash table. You still need to have the block-structured symbol table. So remember, that means you have multiple scopes coexisting. There's an old way that was popular when memory was really expensive. You don't remember that far back, but I remember when I was going to school, and they had a brand new computer down at the computer lab that had a megabyte of memory. Not a gigabyte, not a terabyte, a megabyte. Oh my God, a million bytes, all the stuff we're going to be able to do. And turned out, you know, that in those days, using memory efficiently was important. Wasting a few hundred K here, a few hundred K there, added up. Even a few dozen K, not 100K. So in those days, one way of doing a block-structured symbol table is to have one hash table and index it not just by the identifier name, but also by a scope number. So if I had A appearing three times, I'd say, I'm the A in scope 1, I'm the A in scope 7, I'm the A in scope 13. That works, but it's extra effort, and its only good use is that you can share one big table effectively because many scopes can reuse the same hash table space. What is more common these days is simply to go ahead and create what is conceptually a stack of hash tables. Now, some languages have a stack constructor. Be careful about that because you really need to be able to peek down the stack. So think of it as a stack in the sense that it has one preferred access order, or think of it as a list where the top of the list is the innermost scope, the next is the next containing scope, and so on. And as you open scopes, you add to the head of the list. As you close scopes, you remove from the head of the list. And the global scope is always the last guy on the list because it's the last guy touched. So that means you take an existing data structure like a hash and either use a constructor for lists with a hash data item or build something like a class that has a hash table field and a next field if you're an old timer like me that loves to build linked lists. But conceptually, you have to have a series of tables that can be searched in order, and that's a list. And however you implement it, what version of list you use is up to you. So it's not a big deal. Don't waste more time than you need to, and it'll be fine. Okay, at this stage, I think I've said all I wanted to say about Project 1. And therefore, if you have any residual questions that you think now would be a good spot to answer, please go ahead and do it. Okay, I'm sure other things will come. Oh, good, got one.
Is there anything in scope info that we
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. So you're saying, should you have two choices in the fact that one of the things you for sure have to change is scope info, which I gave you, which is essentially a linked list of scopes. And I said, you're not going to have a linked list of scopes. You're going to have a linked list of ID infos and an auxiliary structure, which is a list of hash tables. And you can either take what's there and edit around it, or just leave it there as a prototype and create a brand new one that says, I'm going to have something different, but its ordering is going to be, basically, there's going to be an ID info, let's say, and an ID info list that represents the sequence. Each ID info will have a name, a type, and another list that represents zero or more uses. And therefore, you're going to need constructors, you're going to need toString, you're going to need various methods. Like, for example, when you see a brand new usage of an identifier, you want to add it to the end of the list in the ID info that represents uses. So you might have a method called append to list or add new use or whatever you call it that will go in there and do all the intermediate steps. So you'll probably want some suitable methods. And you can kind of invent those as you go, but each of them will be simple. So in that case, you don't have to worry about possibly getting some stuff from scope info that really isn't appropriate, but you can still use it as a model. It's got to have constructors, it's got to have toString, it's got to have methods to manipulate, and I think I also added in there some test cases, because it's always good when you build a class like that to have some test methods just to make sure you didn't do something silly before you start using it. So that's a case, again, of doing bit by bit. If you create a brand new class, test it, leave the test stuff in there in case later on you're worried something's not working properly, but then you can start using it. Okay? So what I want to start talking about now will be the next project, which will actually not be released for 2 weeks, but it's something where you probably ought to start thinking about it now because I'm going to have some new ideas and some new tools. So our next step is going to be to build a scanner. But unlike what you might think you're going to do on a scanner, which would be to write a little bit of code that reads characters one by one and says, what kind of character are you? Who do you belong to? What character are you? Who do you belong to? That's the way scanners are done in the old days. There's trouble in that there's some overlap. For example, if I see, and it's been such a productive class that I'm actually running out of blank pages, so I have to write on the backside. Sorry about that. Get some bleed through. So it's the case that if you're doing a scanner by hand, you say you see an eye. You say, oh, I know what you are. You're an identifier. You say, if. Oh, I know. Oh, no, that's not an identifier. That's the reserved word if. But it's not. Maybe it is, but it isn't until you know the next character. So you see another one, and all of a sudden it's an identifier again. So what something is kind of changes character by character. The rule is you keep reading characters until you know for sure what something is. The reason for that is if you didn't do that, you might be tempted to say, this guy is not one identifier, it's three identifiers, each a single character long. That would mean you'd end up in a situation where long identifiers were impossible to get scanned. That's clearly foolish. So if you're reading character by character, you'd obviously have to have this list of what could this be, what could that be. If I have more than one reserved word that begins with the same letter, is it this one or that one? So rather than do that, we're going to develop some terminology notation which allows us to specify precisely a pattern for what various kinds of tokens are, and we'll have a tool which will take those patterns and build a scanner for us. So you're never going to have to program the thing that says, what character is this? What token does it belong to? What character is that? What token does it belong to? The driver that's built automatically will do that from the specifications that you give it. So you'll say, here's reserved words, here's identifiers. You figure out which of these are using the rule that do the longest possible match. And once you find the longest possible match, check the rule. IFF is an identifier. IF without the F is a reserved word. And it'll figure that out for you, which makes your life a lot easier, particularly if you're in a language that has lots of tokens and lots of reserved words. So, and we're also going to get into cases where some tokens are a little bit more complex than others. Quoted strings, for example, is something we're going to have in the language. Why? Well, a language that doesn't have quoted strings can't print stuff out. You can't print stuff out, you can't test programs very effectively. But quoted strings can be remarkably nasty, and they're fairly subtle. And I'll show you one of those right now. Suppose I write down a string like that, and this could be in Java. I've gone ahead and used backslash n. What does backslash n mean in many programming languages? It means a new line. So when you're a scanner, you're going to have to go kind of from this twilight zone that when this is first read, is that a new line? And the answer is no. When you read ordinary characters, say using the simple read commands that Java has, backslash n is not a new line. It becomes a new line only when the compiler runs this magic and says in certain circumstances, backslash n is a new line. And what do I mean that? Well, suppose I have a comment. And I print that guy out, you know, just on a line printer. Will this backslash n disappear and force a new line, or will it come out as a backslash n? Again, you can use kind of a plausibility argument. You know, if it were backslash new line, how could I ever write down backslash new line? Suppose I wanted to write a comment saying, you know, be careful about backslash new line. It turns out, again, it depends on your language, but usually the language for comments does not know about any of this escaping business. So it's up to the scanner to put the little bit of magic in that says, in this sort of thing, when it actually gets to the execution system, this is not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 characters. The two enclosing quotes are gone because they were only part of a way to say, here's the beginning and the end of the string. And it's going to say, in this particular case, I want a new line because the problem is if I wanted to put a new line and I didn't have backslash n, how do I type it in? It's invisible. And there's other ones that are even nastier. I think many computers still honor the fact that backslash g is a special character. Does anybody know what backslash g is on many systems? And it's a very useful sort of thing in the old days. It's the bell character. I remember g for gong, like the gong show. Backslash g will bang. And why would that be cool? Well, in the old days, you know, since you had a program running, you didn't know how long it's going to run. When you print, finding it, the answer is, what would you do? Answer is gong, 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 gong. And it would wake you up if you're napping or talking on the phone or playing Angry Bird or whatever you're doing to fill your time. I know here you work 24/7 and never dream of goofing off. But those sort of things exist. But they're not magic. Somebody puts the magic in, and that's you as a compiler writer. So at some stage, you're going to recognize this and say, hey, in the context of a quoted string, there's these special rules that say a backslash n is not two characters when it's finally translated. It's one character. It's the new line, or a backslash t is the tab, or backslash g is gong. And if you look at Java specification, there's some others that are more obscure but still exist. For our purposes, we just have backslash n for new line and backslash t for tab, just to give you a little flavor for that. But little things like that, to get right in a specification is important, and it's not as trivial as you might guess. So we're going to have to do that sort of thing correctly. We also have the issue, again, partially of unprintable characters. It happens that most languages now have escape sequences, but should you be allowed to have unprintable characters inside a structure like a quoted string? So that means you have to have a backslash. You can have a backslash n for a new line, but are you required to? Can anybody guesstimate again for how language would be used? Should you be allowed to somehow get this magic character, it's one of the ASCII characters, that represents a new line, and shove it between a couple of quotes and put it in your program? Should they allow you to do that? The answer is most languages don't allow it. And here's the question, oh, why? Suppose I were allowed to do that. I say, okay, I don't like backslash n. I want the real hardcore character. Give me the real character. But when I print out my listing to show me or the TA or one of your roommates or office mates, and I had a backslash new line, I might see something like this, where I had a new line somewhere in there, and a quoted string that should have fit on one line is now on two lines. Well, what's terrible about that? What's terrible about it is there used to be a comedian that says, what you see is what you get. But in this particular case, what you see is not necessarily what you get. Tell me, for example, how many characters are in that quoted string. Looking at it, you should be able to tell me because that might be relevant. I have to figure out how long that string is. The answer is I can't tell if I allow this unprintable because this could have been a blank. Let me use a delta to represent a blank. And then finally, I have the new line right there. Or it could be have fewer blanks or no blanks. Can't tell. So many programming languages kind of work to make those sort of ambiguities impossible to write down just because you want to be able to see as a programmer what it is you specified. Now, maybe in some cases you're forced into cases where that can't be done, but certainly as a basic principle. And actually in our language, we're not going to allow a quoted string to cross a line boundary exactly because of that. You can make the line real long if you want, or you can take two consecutive strings, quote them, and somehow combine them. Java lets you do that with a plus. We don't have plus in there, but you would print out two quoted strings of intermediate length rather than one of long length. Again, this is design issues, but we have to be able to specify that, and that's what we're going to get to. So we're going to need a notation. And this notation that I alluded to earlier, the thing where we're going to be able to write down patterns for characters. They could be tokens. They could also be crossword puzzle clues, or if you're at the DMV, there are possible vanity plates that thou shalt not allow, like hating the Cubs. I really don't hate the Cubs. I hate the Cardinals, but that's a different story. The Cubs lose, so who can hate them? The Cardinals win, so it's easier to hate them. So what a regular expression is, think of this as a new kind of mathematical notation, but it's not about numbers. It's about characters and strings. And the notion is I should write a pattern, just like that thing I wrote way back when. Probably not even worth finding. Yeah, this guy right here. Right here. Just this fancy thing let me to write down a very precise kind of arithmetic sequence. I'm going to have something around that allows me to write down patterns of characters that are allowed or disallowed that I can use for tokens. So I can say, if you fit this pattern, you are then a valid quoted string, or you're a valid integer literal, or you're a valid identifier. And if you don't fit this pattern, you're not. And the advantage of that, then, there's no doubt about what's valid or not. If it fits the pattern, it is. If it doesn't fit the pattern, it's not. So it's a step forward from our point of view. I should point out that these things are used in scanner generation, but they're also used in other contexts. In the old days, people used to learn Unix. And it was the case that we tried to teach our staff, our secretarial staff, how to use the Unix operating system. And that didn't work at all. Those were the bad old days. But it used to be the case that I would always be something of a troublemaker, and I'd go to the secretarial staff and say, hey, are you having trouble learning programming? No, here's how you can solve it all. If you really get yourself into a bind. Now, this is a joke. Some of you may understand it, some not, and I'll explain it to you. But this was, I say, type this command in and all your problems will be over. And the question is why? Well, this is similar to DOS if you learn that in situation. And what happens in the Unix system, RM is an abbreviation for remove. Remove what? Files. Star is really what I'm getting to. Star is actually derived from a regular expression pattern in command lines in Unix and also in file descriptors. Star is a catch-all that matches anything and everything. So star will match any and all file names. So RM star says remove everything. Now, these days, things are programmed to say, you don't really mean that. What happens is usually RM is alias to something where it asks you, do you want to remove this one? Do you remove that one? Do you want to remove that one? So if you really want to create havoc, you have to say RM minus RF star. And that does it all. So the minus R is recursive. F is force. That says force it to do it. Don't bother to ask. So this is the really killer command. My point is don't do this. Please, no, don't. Situation. But it's a situation where there's lots of notation that we take for everyday purposes that really is derived from this regular expression notation. As we'll see, star is something that repeats a match. So in this case, star is a simplification of something that says match any sequence of characters. So it turns out that this looks terrible, but actually it's not all that bad an idea. Sometimes, for example, you might want to remove a class of files. So you might want to remove star dot class. That's much more useful. That's a command in Unix and in other systems that says remove all files that have any prefix and are ended with dot class. And that's a way to throw away all class files. You might do that, for example, if you're doing a make clean or a build clean to get rid of compiled stuff and compile from scratch. Sometimes that's a good idea when you're getting error messages because certain compilations clash. Just throw away and rebuild. And that's something that would support. So this sort of notation is used in other places. Editors have something like that. I think even if you're in Google and certain Google pattern searches are based on regular expressions. And Windows Find, which I don't know much about, but somebody told me about it, allows expressions too. So what we're going to do is we're going to start from the mathematical basis. What do arithmetic expressions represent? Represent numbers, typically integers. What we're going to do is represent sets, in particular sets of characters. So we're going to write down a notation that says, here is a notation that represents a sequence of characters that represent one or more strings. The cool thing about this is this may be an infinite set. And generally, manipulating infinite things is hard, but mathematics does it all the time. And we can do it as needed be in a particular case for tokens. What would be the case of an infinite set? May be strange, but the set of legal identifiers in our language is infinitely large. Why is that? It's because I want to duck a hard problem. The hard problem is, how big should an identifier be? In many cases, it's a situation where, in the old days, you may have encountered this, certain limitations were placed on the length of things. So, for example, if you look at my email address in the Duet file system, which was inherited from the earlier guys, my email address so CN fishy. Oh, sorry. I probably should be giving up. Right here. That turns out to be my email address, but that's silly. Because my name is Fisher with an R. And why is the R missing there? Does anybody guess? Well, let's count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And it turns out that in the old days, there was a situation where limited passwords were 8 characters or fewer. In fact, just the other day, I got a message from one of my systems that says, hey, your password's out of date. You got to go ahead and change it. So I went ahead and changed it and said, no, it's the same password. And I read the fine print, and it was the case that only the first 12 characters were accepted. Anything after that was ignored. So, of course, what I did is I took my old one and just put a suffix on it so it was pretty easy to remember. And it didn't even allow me to do that. So computers are wonderful things in terms of screwing up one's life. And in this particular case, I don't want to say how big identifiers are. You can make them as big as you want, and it's between you and your supervisor. If you and your supervisor think that's a good length, it's fine with me. So that's why we'd possibly, and other things too, like integers. I won't even have the length limit on the length of integers. And the reason for that is one of the oddities we have in computing is we have all this memory, and yet oftentimes things like integers are limited in length to 16 bits, 32 bits, 64 bits. It's certainly possible to imagine programs that want numbers bigger than that. And what happens is these days you have to program them explicitly using infinite precision package, as they call it. But my guess is in future, you're going to have things that are much more flexible in terms of integers, so that if you want to compute something that's bigger than 16 bits or 32 or 64, you got plenty of memory, it'll go ahead and do it and give you just the right size for the number you want. So that's another reason to have no limit on the size of things, because systems will support bigger and bigger values. So the way this thing will work, and let me get another recycled page. Next time I'll bring more pages. Oh, good. That's one where I got plenty of blank space. So what's going to happen is these particular notations were first developed by theoretical computer scientists. So they had to have mathematical-like notation. Don't let it worry you. It's not too much of it. So it turns out that when we start defining tokens, we have to have a particular vocabulary. And for some reason or other, the vocabulary is called sigma. Don't worry too much about it. Our vocabulary will be the ASCII character set. There are other character sets around. IBM used to use something called EBCDIC, which is 256 varieties. And now one of the nice things that Java does is it has something called Unicode. And Unicode has characters actually be 2 bytes long. And one of the cool things about this is we're no longer limited to just the Roman alphabet that English speakers and Europeans are familiar with. Now you're allowed to have Hebrew, Arabic, Hindi, linearized version of Japanese, kanji, I think it's called. I think Korean is included. I think there's some varieties of Chinese. I'm not positive about that allowed. And virtually any and all of the popular human languages are allowed. So even though I'm talking about scanning in what looks like English, if that's not your native language and you'd prefer having something in Hindi or Korean or anything else that's supported, this system will accept that. You'd simply have to have, obviously, different characters. But and actually, that turns out to be pretty handy. I don't know if it's still true. In fact, it probably is. It used to be in the old days that whenever you had a programming language and you shipped it to France, all the reserved words had to become French. So whatever begin is in French, you know, and end and if and all that. And it used to be a real bother until somebody realized with automatic scanner generators, it's the easiest thing in the world. French still uses the Roman alphabet. So you just find somebody who speaks French and whatever if is, find a reserved word definition for if and change it to, what is French for if? Come on, it's got to be a simple one. In German, it's wenn, but Germans, you know, they got beat by the Americans, so they had to use our language. The French got beat by the Germans, but not by us, so they used their own language. Whatever. So situation there is by having these patterns, a lot of things that otherwise are difficult are pretty easy and just something there. But we do need a vocabulary, and for our purposes, just think ASCII, but that's not as much of a limitation. If you want to do it in your own language and using your own character set, Unicode would be a great way of doing it, and they have enough space to have a huge number of symbols. So we'll use ASCII, as I said, and here's that Unicode business. One thing that always bothers people is one of the special kinds of strings we have is a string that has nothing in it. It's a cognate of number zero, and that's called the null string. If I were to write the null string in quotes, I'd write that. And it turns out many programming languages allow that. You may not have realized it, but I can have a string that has no characters in it. It turns out that if I don't have the quotes, a notation is used as lambda, and that represents a string that has zero characters in it. Well, why would you want to have a character that has nothing in it? And the answer is, of course, it's a great initial value for a string that you're going to build up. If I'm going to start reading characters one by one, what should I start from? Obviously, something that has zero characters in it, that's lambda or the null string. So it looks a little odd at first, but it is really fairly useful. So in arithmetic, we build up numbers by doing things like addition and subtraction and multiplication and division. We're going to build strings from individual characters or other strings, and one of the first things we'll use is catenation. That is, we can take characters or strings and jam them together into bigger strings or characters. So one way to do that is to write down individual characters and extend the string. But I can also go ahead and take another string and catenate together. So one way I'll build strings, and I'll show you examples of that in a bit, is by taking a prefix and a suffix and joining them together. When there's only one string in the set, it doesn't matter so much, but for bigger sets, it does. You can catenate lambda to things. So I can start out with lambda, read a character A, and have that. Well, once I have a character, I don't need the lambda anymore, so this is the same thing as writing A. I can then read B and C and so on. I can also take sets of strings, one of which represents possible prefixes and the other represents suffixes. Let's let P represent a set. That'll typically be written by some expression, and Q be another set. And if I put those adjacent, I go ahead and do catenation. Actually, when we write them down, we're going to have a space so that we don't misinterpret P and Q as one name. But the notion of catenation is a fundamental idea. It's not very hard, but something that's extremely important. Another choice is alternation. You can have this choice or that or that. And by doing alternation, I can write down sets of very convenient, I should say write convenient sets that represent familiar concepts. So one of them, for example, is when I'm writing down numbers, is to write down a digit. What I'll use in this notation is an OR bar. So the digits represent 0 or 1 or... I'm using ellipses, but that's only because I'm lazy. I'd write down the entire sequence a la this. So I can write down individual elements by using an OR bar, and I can do that in sets too. So that would be, I could have a set A or set B. And again, if this seems a little abstract, it's only because I haven't given you tangible examples yet. Well, shortly. And there are special meta characters that are used specially, and they have to be quoted or escaped, and I'll show you that in a bit. So if I have sets of strings, I can have, as I said here, an alternation that says, okay, anything in set A, or in this case set P, or in set Q is choosable, and take your choice. Well, again, that's pretty abstract, so let's go ahead and use this example here. Suppose I write down all the examples of lowercase letters, and that would equal A or B or all the way to Z or Z. I once had a Canadian in class who absolutely demanded I use Z. And I could use uppercase, and those would be uppercase letters or capital Z. Well, in some cases, I might say, I don't care if you use uppercase or lowercase. So instead of writing a third set, I can simply use the OR bar that says if I define lowercase as that and uppercase as that, the set of all possible letters, all 52 of them, are the uppercase or the lowercase. So there's use for that. And let's see. We're out of time. Sorry about that. This is a good place to stop, and I promise I'd get you out by 8:30, and I looked in, we were a little over. So we'll pick up clean enclosure next time and start showing some tangible examples. So this stuff is in preparation for the next project, and by the time the project is due, you'll understand it all. And I'll bring more paper next time.